So let's begin with a question tonight. Why was... No, that's a bad question. What is, better, Charles Dickens' novel A Christmas Carol about? We all know this. Anybody? Game to summarize? Parker, you know the answer, right? You just look like you know the answer?
I know the story. But...
Okay, what's the story about? Can you summarize it in like a sentence? Nope.
Well, it's talking about, like, Scrooge
realizing... Oh, God. Scrooge! There he is. Right, he's been identified.
Like, meaning, like, finding the meaning of life and of Christmas is, like, it's, well, it was really, like, evaluating, like, seeing his life in the past, seeing his life in the present, and then in the future how it would be.
Yeah.
And so, like, how he can live differently in the present, like, because he doesn't want that reality that...
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That probably wasn't a good memory, but.
Everybody follow with that though? Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Okay. Good job. Good job. Scrooge is leaving now. So, all right. All right. We're done. We're done. Well, anyway, something of what those three benevolent ghosts were intended to be for Scrooge is something of what this chapter is intended to be for John's direct audience as he writes his apocalypse. Who, remember, is his direct audience? People are saying it, but it's too quiet to know who.
The churches.
The churches. Which churches? Which ones?
The seven ones
at the beginning, right? So think, you know, late first century. It's these churches. Are these churches having a good time presently?
Only really one.
Yeah.
Only really one.
It's a very difficult time, right? There's pressure to compromise. There's persecution, which is causing pressure to compromise, which is having economic issues. They're kind of kicked out from the social structures of society, so they can't make money, they can't get jobs, it's hard to get what they need, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of cost to be a believer in this age. And so John is writing to encourage those churches with their future state before the throne of God, so that the thinking is, if you understand what you're going to be, which is really what you are now because you have Christ and he's there, you're there before the throne. Remember Colossians 3, you are already seated in the heavenly places with him. Look at what you are. Let all of this encourage you now. That's what's going on in this chapter. So we've just come through in verse 1 to 8, the passage about the 144,000. Last week, and as we press on tonight, do not forget what we concluded then. Abigail gave us a great summary of it, but here it is also. Though some believe the 144,000 to be a literal number or group, we do not. Instead, we believe this to be a symbolic number of the church as the true restored remnant of Israel, whose salvation has been secured. And so John uses an exact number to identify them, to display how God has exactly determined who his people are and who they will be. And in verse 9, John transitions in our text in chapter 7, not to a different group, but to the same group of people now described differently. In verse 9 to 7, we see the same redeemed remnant from their actual vast number, or we could call it what R.C. Sproul calls this, a multitudinous throng. It's a wonderful phrase. We should all learn that tonight. It just means a countless number of people. Multitudinous throng. Or he could say it like this. John's already experienced something like this in his apocalypse. Just as John earlier in chapter 5, verse 5 and 6, he heard about a victorious lion and saw how that victory was achieved by then seeing the lamb standing though slain. So he saw, he heard something, and then saw something that clarified what he heard. Here, in chapter 7, John hears about a number, 144,000, and then more completely understands what that number is as he sees before the throne a vast multitude worshiping. That's what we see. And so if you recall, 2 weeks ago, Andrew went over five options as to what the 144,000 are. And I believe we concluded that though he was firmly in number five, the restored remnant of Israel, he did say that number four is a healthy option. That's actually the option I think is going on, a four and five, which is a victorious kind of battle imagery of what's going on, a military there. For all of that info, I just refer you back to the podcast. Listen to it. It's at the start. Very well done. Very informative. Military might or an army is in view. And I think that's further seen in our text in verse 9 to 17. Because the word translated as a multitude in verse 9 in other apocalyptic passages is also translated as army. Also, white robes and palm branches carry loads of military meaning in other passages as well. And lastly, salvation in verse 10 could also be translated victory. So if all this is in view, the exact number of the true restored remnant of Israel seen in verse 1 to 8 is now seen in verse 9 to 17 as a victorious, military-minded, battle-worn host far greater than any John has ever seen. And so we'll look at 2 points this evening. Verse 9 to 12, the God worshipped. And then verse 13 to 17, the throng worshiping. So first, the God worshipped. Look at verse 9 to 12. After this, I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands and crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." And all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures, and they fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, "Amen! Blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. Amen." So as our passage begins in verse 9, there is a phrase, after this. After this does not mean that he sees what he sees in verse 9 to 7 historically after the events of 1 to 8, but only that the vision of verse 9 to 17 comes after the vision of verse 1 to 8. So in this vision, which is very similar to chapter 5, verse 9 and 10, there's a multitudinous throng beyond count from every nation, tribe, peoples, and languages. And as they're standing before the Lamb in chapter 5, they're doing the same here. This language, again, we've been talking a lot about this, especially the past few weeks going through 2 Samuel. This has a lot to do with the Abrahamic covenant. Not only would God bless every family on earth through him, but God would so increase and build his family that they'll be more numerous than the stars in the heavens. Those two promises are coupled together in one passage later on in Genesis 22, verse 17 to 18, where we read, "I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed." So let's track with that promise a little bit. This promise originally made to Abraham would slowly but surely begin to come to pass as his descendants, Israel, now safe in Egypt, grow to a number that is almost difficult to count. And then they're enslaved but redeemed by God in the Exodus, and the picture of God's innumerable, victorious, redeemed people walking out, plundering the Egyptians comes into view. Numbers chapter 20, verse 25 mentions that they had grown so large that they had become a people that were hard to count. And not only so, but they were a victorious people, not because of their own might, but because of what God did for them in plundering the Egyptians, giving them the way out, bringing them to Sinai to worship. And so to here, I think John sees something of the fulfillment of that image. Christ's greater exodus results in this group before the throne of the redeemed, impossible to number, victorious not because of their own might, but because of Christ's might to save them and defeat their enemy in his greater exodus, ultimately bringing them before his throne to worship him. Just like Israel of old, this group is the fulfillment of that. And then in the back half of verse 9 and 10, John sees this multitude in white robes and palm branches saying, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." That their robes are white is clarified further in the passage in verse 13 and 14, where it says they wash their robes white in the blood of the Lamb, which displays not only the sin-stained people they used to be, but the purity and righteousness of Christ that's been freely given to them by faith in the present moment. That they're holding palm branches in their hands is an image familiar to us. That does not mean that the scene before the throne will be the scene in Florida or any other place where there are palms, the West Coast or our coast or Vietnam even. There's palms everywhere there. It means that this redeemed host is celebrating an end-time feast of booths. Israel did this once to remember and rejoice what God did in the Exodus. And so there's no coincidence that we're going back even here to talk about Abraham and the promise of them becoming a multitude that's beyond count. We saw it come to pass with him, and slowly but surely as we get to Egypt, and all of a sudden the Exodus is once again in view. They rejoiced what God had did with waving palm branches in their hand. And here we see the same image. Fast forward to the throne of heaven, they're still holding the palm branches. Now this group is doing it to remember and rejoice how God saved them through Christ. And once they proclaim aloud their praise to God, the whole of heaven responds. The angels, the elders, the four living creatures around the throne, they all fall on their faces and worship God, making their own proclamation in verse 12, which begins and ends with the word Amen, to emphatically confirm the rightness of this praise to God and to the Lamb. This, too, is something of a mirror we saw in chapter 5. Of the scene before the throne there. And so as it was there, so it is here. The God who saves is victorious for his people, and he alone is due such praise for such work and what he has done. That is the God worshipped in verse 9 to 12. Let's look now in verse 13 to 17 at the throng worshiping. Verse 13. Then one of the elders addressed me, saying, "Who are these clothed in white robes, and from where have they come?" I said to him, "Sir," which could also mean Lord, "you know." And he said to me, "These are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him night, day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd, and he will guide them to springs of living water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. We now find out a little bit more about this multitudinous throng before the throne. One of the elders, interesting how this plays out, right? One of the elders comes to John and says, "Who is this group and where have they come from?" And understandably, John responds in the only way he can know how, "Lord," or "Sir, you know." And of course he does. And so there's all sorts of humorous opinions about why that interchange happens in commentaries. If you'd like to go explore that, we can do that later, or you can look up that. It is kind of humorous. There's no real, I think, fruit to such an endeavor. This happened. Let's move on. Who are these white-robed people, and where do they come from? And so the elder responds and answers his own question with two things. First, they are from the great tribulation. And second, they are the ones who have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. So let's take those one at a time. What does the elder refer to when he says this vast host is from the great tribulation? This is now the first place, I believe, in Revelation we're introduced to the phrase, the great tribulation. The origin of this kind of language is not here in John, but it goes all the way back to Daniel chapter 12, verse 1, which says this: "At that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble, such as never has been since there was a nation till that time. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book." So in Daniel's context, for chapter 12, this time of trouble, which John writes as great tribulation, describes a time when God's people are being severely persecuted because of their loyalty to and devotion to God. Some turned away from God because of this. Others remained faithful to God during this. And you can imagine that those that remained faithful as opposed to those that left, they were persecuted the more severely because of it. The same kind of reality is no surprise for us as we've been walking through these chapters of Revelation, right? It's the same kind of imagery that we get in chapter 2 and 3 with the seven churches, most of whom were in the exact same struggle that Daniel 12 mentions, a world that hates them, a world that strongly opposes them, that's putting some to death for holding fast to Christ. The great tribulation, then, is this. It is a time where there is great pressure to compromise, to give in or to give up, to turn your back on Christ. This consists of social pressures, economic pressures, and physical pressures that they would all be delivered from if they denied Christ. But to continue to be faithful to Christ means they were going to enter into all of this strife and turmoil. The elder tells John, this vast host that you cannot count, it's from that time. The great tribulation. They're all from that time. Interesting, right? They're all from that time, meaning all of them, not just a segment of them that came in later. The whole multitudinous throng is from one time period called the great tribulation. So notice here, according to all of this, the great tribulation is not something that will occur at the end of all things, as is commonly held, but it's something that occurs all throughout the age that Christ's church is expanding and spreading all throughout the world. Remember chapter 1, John introduced himself in verse 9. I, John, your brother and partner in the, does anybody remember? Tribulation with you. So it's how he introduced himself. So for John in the church is addressed here in his apocalypse, this tribulation wasn't something that they were waiting for, but it's something that's very much for them an already present reality. Sure, there will be great tribulation in the end, but that tribulation that's commonly held is not going to be anything new. It's just going to be a continuation of the tribulation that's already in existence now for John and his original audience, for us, the church. We'll get questions after. Second, so after we learn this host is from the great tribulation, we also learn that this host is the group that has washed their robes white in the blood of the Lamb. We already mentioned this back in verse 9 when it referenced that they have on these robes. But now we can take it a step further and say that the only reason this host can stand before God in the manner that they are is by no work of their own, but only the work of that Lamb they're praising for them. His death washed them clean, made them white, secured their redemption. And verse 15 picks up on this right away and continues to pull on this thread and gives us reasons alone that they, one, have direct access to God, two, can be before the throne of God, three, enjoy serving God day and night, and four, enjoy being sheltered by the presence of God. That's what this group enjoys. They're the people of God that have been redeemed by God, who are now worshiping God, enjoying the blessings of God before the throne of God. So, question, in the old covenant, who was it that ministered to God day and night in his presence? The priests. The priests. Only they could come and do this. Which is why this morning in the 2 Samuel passage, when it ended, David's sons were priests, means that David should not have done that. Only the Levites should have been priests. But he made his sons priests, I think wrongly, right? David's kingdom's a preview of Christ. It's not a perfect kingdom. Here we see perfection. The whole innumerable host of the redeemed is the kingdom of priests and a holy nation, day and night before the throne of God, serving him and enjoying his blessings. But what blessings? This is key. Specifically, blessings that are only promised, or that were originally promised, to national Israel. So back in Isaiah 25:8 and Isaiah 49:9-10, these promises about being in the direct presence of God and enjoying the blessings of God were something that was given to them concerning their ultimate restoration. God saying, I will do this for you. But see in verse 16 and 17, even though national Israel received this promise originally and tasted its fulfillment in part, it's God's new Israel, it's God's new people, the multitude of believers from all nations who enjoys the fullness of all these blessings. Right there before the throne, who is it that enjoys these? Not only Israelites, nationally, every language, tribe, people, and tongue, believers that have been washed white in the blood of the Lamb, they're the ones that enjoy the promises that were made to national Israel. That's what we see here. No hunger, no thirst, no heat. That begins the list in verse 16, but it all indicates Christ's full ability to satisfy every desire of the heart in every one of his chosen. And then it concludes with a grand statement in verse 17, where John hears that a great and glorious Lamb shepherd will be their shepherd, guiding them into springs of living water and wiping away every tear from their eyes. And so this lamb shepherd will lead them, will guide them, and will comfort them, ultimately being the climax fulfillment of Psalm 23, is what we see happening. Psalm 23, written by a shepherd, David, who then experiences being made the shepherd of Israel, who then realizes through his own foibles and failures that he is not the shepherd that God's people ultimately need. And then, lo and behold, one day comes the good shepherd who we think, when you lay down your life, or if you die and you're the shepherd, the sheep will die too. Well, by laying down his life, Jesus, for his sheep, he secures the salvation for his sheep, rises from death, secures their redemption, leads them an everlasting host. And there before the throne, the lamb shepherd is still the image in view. And think back to Psalm 23, verse 1 to 4. It's our good shepherd who leads and guides and nourishes into wide pastures with running streams. It's all symbolic imagery that God taking care of every need of his people. And then in the back half of the psalm, it goes from our good shepherd to God, the gracious host. There's all of a sudden a house and a banquet and a feast, a table spread in the presence of our enemies, it says. Well, this is the ultimate climactic fulfillment of that moment. We're witnessing it before our eyes.